This is from the naturalist Edwin Wade Teal. The rugged old Norsemen spoke of death as hingon, home guard. So the snow flowers go home when they melt and flow into the sea. The rock ferns, after unrolling their fronds to the light and beautifying the rocks, roll them up, close again in the autumn, and blend with the soil. Myriads of rejoicing creatures, daily, hourly, perhaps every moment, sink into death's arms, dust to dust, spirit to spirit. But they are waited on, watched over, each arriving at its own destiny. All the merry dwellers of the trees and the streams and the myriad swarms of the air, call into life by the sunbeam on the summer morning, all go home, wings folded perhaps in the last red rays of sunset of the day they were first tried. Trees towering in the sky, braving storms of centuries, flowers turning faces to the light for a single hour or day, having enjoyed their share of life's feasts, all alike pass on and away under the law of life, death, and love. And yet we are all sisters and brothers, and we all enjoy life as they do, as we do. We all share life's blessings. We all die and are buried in hallowed ground. We all come out of eternity and return to eternity. Our lives are finally rounded with a little sleep. Ministers to complain about the commercialization of Christmas. I have a different complaint. I'm here today to complain about the commercialization of Halloween. Of course, I have to admit I indulge in it myself. There's nothing I like better than handing out chocolate communion to the young children. What else is it? It is chocolate communion. And why I decry the commercialization of Halloween, I have to admit I make at least two stops this time of year to those strip mall stores, the Halloween Express. I love them. It is a magical time of year. But at the same time, this time of year and Halloween itself has come to mean something very different than it did even a generation ago. Halloween is the new commercial children's version of what used to be ancient and sacred holidays. This time of year is the time of Samhain for pagans. It's the time of All Souls for Christians. It's the time of Day of the Dead in Mexico. So many different religions and cultures have used this time of year not just to play pranks and indulge in acts of petty vandalism, but to ask a very, very serious question. That question being, have we made enough room for death in our living and in our life? And it would seem that we 21st century Americans especially might have special reasons for needing to ask and answer this question. We handle death, dying, and grief differently than any culture or any religion that this planet has known. And we might ask ourselves if we're handling it in a way that really supports our spiritual grounding and our sense of community, or if we haven't taken a wrong step somewhere. Of course, it's hard to step out of your own culture and see your own practices and know that there are alternatives. I think one of the few ways to do this is understand how other cultures and other religions handle rituals. And so if you would indulge me, I'd like to begin today by describing three different deathbed scenes from three different cultures and asking ourselves what they have in common and what we do differently. I want to begin with the indigenous, because this is how most of humanity has greeted death and dying for most of history. Just for the sake of argument, I'll take the customs of a small tribe in Indonesia. In this particular tribe, I'm going to imagine that a woman is dying. As it becomes clear that her illness is fatal, she is brought back to her home, where she is tended by her husband and by the family and villagers who gather. It's understood that in this point of time, the dying woman can make any request, and it will be the obligation of those who hear it to meet it. Often the dying woman will make requests for luxury food items, palm wine. Even if she can't necessarily drink or enjoy them, the request is made and the request is honored. As she becomes sicker it's understood that she will start to speak and not make sense because she is no longer conversing with the living, but she's conversing with the souls who have gone on before her, perhaps her dead relatives, perhaps her ancestors, starting to commune with her, starting to bring her one step further away from the entirely human plane. When she dies, her death will not be acknowledged for weeks. When she physically dies, her body remains in her husband's house. Her husband remains close to it, and it is forbidden to say that this woman has died. Instead, the villages will speak of her as someone who is sleeping or as someone who has a fever. She will be continued to be offered food and wine. She will be told when members of the household are coming or going. There will be no acknowledgement of what's happened as death until the time of the funeral, set by an astrologer some weeks after what we would have recognized as her death. Of course, it would be difficult to live with the body in this time, but for all the difficulties and for all of what might gross us out as 21st century Westerners, it is still forbidden to acknowledge that this is anything but a live person. So the time of the funeral comes, and now this woman can be acknowledged as dead, but 2 weeks are taken for the funeral. 2 weeks to move the body gradually from the house to a place of ritual in the village, and only then to the cave where she will be buried. Only at the time of the funeral is her husband now officially entering into mourning. And during the funeral and after the mourning, he has certain rituals he has to observe. He will wear black. He is to abstain from those luxury food items that were before offered to the dying. And then at some point in that morning, it is believed that the husband will have a dream where the wife comes to him and offers him some advice, some aid, or some help. And that dream is thought to bring an end to the period of mourning. That's a death in an indigenous society. Now let me take you to another time and place and talk about a death in Tibet before the Chinese invasion amongst a Buddhist family living in the country. And here too, once a person becomes ill, they are brought back into the folds of their family home and cared for there. In this particular culture, the group, the family, would belong to a burial society which shares a common deity that guards over them and which communally owns a cremation of them. So it is understood from the time when someone becomes seriously ill, it is the obligation of this larger community now to care for both the family and for the dying person. So the house becomes a very big, busy place, with the community bringing butter, tea, and other comforts to the family as they watch over the deathbed. It's a religious occasion too. And as it's clear that death is imminent, the family sends to the local monastery, Buddhist monastery, for the lamas who will read the Tibetan Book of the Dead. The Tibetan Book of the Dead is an amazing document, and I think it must offer tremendous comfort to the families who witness this being read to their loved one as they are in the act of dying. Because the Tibetan Book of the Dead lays out exactly what happens to the dying and dead person as it is going on. And so the monks come and they sit by the bedside for days, giving the family this ritual with which to move as they are cared for by the community. And so the lama reads and explains to the dying person that you are now in the act of dying. You will see a great light. Unlike Western tales of great light and near-death experiences, in Buddhism, this great light is not thought to be a good thing. It is often terrifying. And so the lama's instruction to the dying person is to understand that the fear involved in seeing this light is just a projection of human weakness, and that enlightenment is available if you can realize that your own human self is an illusion, and that in fact you belong purely to something larger. Most people aren't capable of this particular